Good afternoon. You're listening to the September 6th edition of The LaRouche Show. My name is Bruce Director, and I will be your host. Lyndon LaRouche has stated recently that we are on the verge of the greatest renaissance that mankind has ever known. You wouldn't know it, though, if you look around at the collapsing economies and culture of Europe and North America. But fortunately, LaRouche and his wife Helga are focused on what's happening in the world as a whole. From that standpoint, we see tremendous changes underway, with China leading the way in science and technology and major advances in space and the application of new levels of infrastructure not seen anywhere before on this planet. The BRICS countries have agreed to the beginning of a new financial system designed for economic growth instead of the financial parasitism dominant in Europe and the U.S. Egypt is developing a new Suez Canal and a major program for greening the desert. Nicaragua has announced its plans to build a new transoceanic canal with the help of the Chinese. And Argentina is telling the Wall Street vulture funds to stuff it. Most people in the United States and Europe are oblivious to these developments and see the world trending toward a period of decay. Some embrace this with sorrowful pessimism, while others long for the good old days when the so-called Western countries were progressing. But going back to the old times won't do anymore. LaRouche has emphasized that America and Europe must be looking to new ideas that most people never thought of before. Just as in the 15th century European Renaissance, it was not just a turning back to the Greeks, but was a whole new way of thinking, today's Renaissance is looking to a whole new set of ideas. LaRouche has indicated that this is a new Promethean age. Joining me today to explore this new turn are two members of the LaRouche research team, Jason Ross and Megan Beetz, both of whom have distinguished themselves as forward-looking thinkers in the domain of science and art. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
So, LaRouche has said there's a new renaissance going, and this harkens back to Prometheus. Let me start with you, Jason. You've spoken a lot on the New Paradigm show about Prometheus and his significance. This is an old myth. Why do we think about it with new ideas?
Well, I think it's because, for one thing, it stands out as a very powerful story, and also because it's a very universal story despite its age. Or maybe I should say, in because of its age, its universality has been demonstrated. You know, it's not a specific story. You know, the story of Prometheus, I think because it is set as a story between immortals, gods, titans, certainly makes it extra timeless. But Prometheus, who gave mankind fire as the basis for a number of other sciences, I mean, Prometheus gave mankind creativity. He says very explicitly that, for those unfamiliar with it, after Prometheus gave fire to mankind, Zeus, who was very upset because he wanted fire and power all to himself, had Prometheus chained up to be tortured for forever. Prometheus said, look, you know, people weren't really humans before I came around. They had eyes, but they didn't know what they were looking at. They had ears. They didn't understand anything. They had no clue. They didn't know when it was a good time to plant crops and harvest them. They didn't know how to make houses. They didn't know how to use animals. They didn't have fire. They didn't have music. They didn't have numbers. They didn't have poetry. Nothing. And Prometheus says that it was, you know, because of what he gave us, it really was the creation of the human species. He said he gave creativity, and that distinguishes us from the animals. So, you know, I think because of the universality of that gift, that it, for one thing, fire in its different forms continues to be a powerful gift. We still have new types of fire that, you know, Zeus is holding on to that we need to get our hands on today, like fusion, which has scientific problems, but also very major political problems holding back its realization. And, so I think for those reasons, I mean, we've got new forms of fire that we need to get today, and creativity, it's hard to get much more general than that in terms of a blessing to mankind and an identity that we should all strive for.
Well, this is very important. This concept of creativity, by its definition, is creating something which doesn't currently exist, which is a quality that only human beings possess. We can imagine states of man and nature which which are not now existent, and bring those things into existence. So here we are in this current state of collapse, at least in the North America and its transatlantic area. We're also faced with huge crises like the drought in California, the problem of feeding the world's population, the problem of lack of water generally, the problems of disease, forget all the financial problems, but just dealing with the actual physical conditions of mankind on this planet. So why don't you just sort of tick off or give us a sense of what kind of solutions to these crises are necessary in terms of what doesn't exist today. As for example, LaRouche has recently, last night on his webcast, gave the example of the drought in California. And he said the situation is absolutely hopeless. There is no solution to the drought in California unless you look to something new which doesn't currently exist. So when you start to look through some of these problems that mankind is facing, the actual problems like the threat of asteroid defense or the development of antibiotic resistant forms of disease, or dealing with new diseases such as cancers and existing diseases which we don't now have a cure from. Give us a sense of what domain we need to be thinking about if we're going to be having to stop these deal with these kinds of problems.
Well, I think a good way of looking at how to solve problems is to look at, let's take a look at problems we don't have and why we don't have those problems.
Okay.
And how can we expand the domain of problems we don't have? For example, you know, I don't think anybody on Earth has the problem of not having any idea when to plant crops. I think the use of the calendar is pretty well established all over the globe.
Okay, and, you know, that's a good point.
That's not a problem.
But that wasn't always the
case, right? It wasn't always the case.
There was a point where people didn't have, like, for example, the development of solar versus lunar calendars, which is not so easy, right?
True.
You're an expert in capital.
Right. Or think of other problems, like, gee, how are we going to move this thing? Oh, we can use a wheel. Like, that's not, no one like wonders how, you know, how to make a shape that rolls easily anymore. Or, you know, I've got a thought, how can I keep it so that I can come back to it later? Well, we have writing. That doesn't mean people know how to write particularly well necessarily, but we have, you know, that's not a problem for us. You know, we have language. We can talk to each other. We have words. We don't just grunt.
Although we're losing that in the internet age, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, we have acronyms now. So, you know, those might seem like,
We have emoticons
like,
now.
You're right. But, you know, there are problems we still do have, like drought. Like, that is a problem now. It really shouldn't be. And you say, what kind of society wouldn't have to worry about droughts ever? Well, a society that would never have to worry about droughts would be one that could do some combination of controlling the weather and taking as much water out of the ocean as you want and desalinating it.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, you know, what, you know, in terms of how to control the weather, well, we don't really, that's definitely a scientific problem that's unresolved at this point, but it's certainly not impossible. And as far as desalination goes, you know, we know how to desalinate ocean water. We've got pretty efficient methods of doing that now. If we had a sufficiently large power supply, say with fusion or even today with fission, you know, at least for coastal areas, drought would never, it just wouldn't be an issue. It would be as bizarre as saying, oh, it's dark now, I can't look at anything. We'd turn on lights, at least places that have electricity or a fire.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd say, well, how do we get to the point where those problems are solvable? So that includes physically, with things like just needing the power for it. And then also culturally, what kind of culture would solve problems instead of claiming that they're impossible? You know, we've got a real can't-do attitude right now in the Atlantic sector.
Well, that's a very good point, this question of culture, right? Because this can't-do attitude versus, say, a more can-do attitude, which we're seeing in China and Asia and so forth. So let me ask you, Megan, to jump in here, because you're a musician. You've done a lot of presentations on music and so forth. How does that relate to this question of culture? And what kind of transformations have occurred in mankind as a result of this question of culture?
Right. Well, that, I think, goes back to what you brought up in the beginning, that LaRouche said we're on the verge of the greatest renaissance in history. And it really goes to what Mr. LaRouche has been repeating over and over in the recent period, that people today don't know what a human being is. People don't actually know what mankind is. And, you know, you go to the domain of classical artistic composition, the classical modes of poetry, what we saw a special peak really in the 19th century in Europe, mm-hmm. with the greatest poets like Percy Shelley, with the greatest classical composers like Beethoven, Brahms, before that Mozart, Bach. You see an actual progress in the capability of the development of the human imagination to a point where the activity of the human imagination is actually able to apprehend, to tap into new ideas, which are valid ideas. Mm-hmm. And this is a tradition that really goes back to the Italian Renaissance. And that's where, you know, that's where really people today need to find their grounding in history, need to find their identity in history, is in the legacy from the Italian Renaissance, with the work of people like Nicholas of Cusa, who said, no, human beings, the human being is a unique creature. We're a co-creator, mm-hmm. in the sense that we're an image of God in our creative powers and our mastery over principles. And since that time, since the Renaissance, you had over a couple of centuries, you had the unleashing of incredible progress in that vein. First with Kepler, which is very much connected to the work of J.S. Bach in composition and the ability to embody a new idea into a form where it can be expressed and communicated to a large number of people. And then you had that thread from Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, mm-hmm. up until today. And it really is the question of developing our population's, the capacity of our population's mind to apprehend new ideas. Mm-hmm. And this is not something which we take in through the senses. And that's actually something we took up for discussion on the New Paradigm show the past 2 weeks, is the fraud of the legacy of Aristotle, mm-hmm. and all oligarchy, who insists that the only way you know something is by experience.
Well, this is a paradox to a lot of people, because they say, well, you say you don't get this through the senses, but you know music, you know music through your sense of hearing. Mm-hmm. You know, classical painting is another area in the Renaissance where you saw a transformation in the visual depiction in art of man. Mm-hmm. Right, if you go to any major gallery in the world, they always have the paintings sort of organized chronologically. Like if you go to the National Gallery here in Washington, D.C., and you see, you know, the pre-Renaissance paintings, and then you see a very, very startling transformation in the you know, 15th century between the way human beings are depicted in these paintings. Going through Rembrandt and so forth, but this is, you see it with your eyes. So what do you mean? You on the one hand, you know, you don't get this through the senses, but on the other hand, it's mediated through the senses.
Yeah, we'll take a good example that I think is a little bit easier to apprehend is drama.
Okay.
Take the work of Shakespeare or Schiller.
Okay.
And you have a person come into the theater, and the lights go down, and the lights on the stage come up, mm-hmm. and if it's a good drama, and it's a good production of the drama, there's a, right from the beginning, there's a lunge where the person's imagination has to be engaged. Mm-hmm. And in a good drama, what unfolds on stage is the person's imagination is gripped, and what unfolds on stage, the physical people, the physical set or whatever's there, in a sense becomes a stand-in, a shadow, almost like a marking point for something which is actually unfolding in the imagination. And that activity, which a lot of people might be able to relate to, be familiar with, where, you know, at the end of the drama, when the curtain falls after the last scene and you sort of, you're broken out of the world that you were in, that's also true of all great classical art. Mm-hmm. Take music, take this performance that Mr. LaRouche references of Schubert's Ninth Symphony, which there was a great performance in 1951 by Wilhelm Furtwängler, which mm-hmm. we fortunately have a recording of.
Right.
And right from the moment that it begins, your imagination is gripped. Mm-hmm. And so, while yes, the ears are engaged, there's a medium of expression of an idea. If it's a good performance, a good piece of art, the medium becomes a means to grip the imagination.
So that's why when two people are in an audience or several people in the audience, either in a musical performance or a drama or looking at the same painting in a gallery, will then talk about what they see. And the two people are describing something completely different because what they're actually talking about is not what was objectively there outside themselves, but they're talking about the effect it had on their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality, in a certain sense, is in the imagination, not in what most people think is reality. So I think that's a very important point. And let me ask Jason to talk about this, because, okay, we talked about these problems, these physical economic problems which face mankind. The solution to them is in the imagination. What kind of solutions are people imagining right now? Like, we look at China, for example, and they're coming up with some creative solutions that people in other parts of the world might have imagined but didn't really take very far. So just to try and give our listeners, because a lot of people who are listening to this are in the ocean of the clueless, as I guess we might say, which is a reference to Helga Lepp LaRouche, just so our listeners know, makes this reference to the valley around Dresden when it was in East Germany, and the people there had, because it was in a physical valley, they didn't get a lot of communications from the outside world, so they had no idea what was going on around them. But if you were to look at the world today, it seems like, you know, the transatlantic region as a whole between Europe and North America, people here are really oblivious to some of the really tremendous developments which are happening around the world. So can you give us, Jason, a little bit of a taste of what kind of unimaginable things people are actually imagining?
Well, I think for Americans, something that might be unimaginable is getting on a high-speed train. certainly they got, you know, a huge network of that in China, including the world's only commercial maglev train that goes from Shanghai to the airport. There was a funny story. Well, anyway, whatever. I was at an event about infrastructure, and Governor Rendell from Pennsylvania had talked about how he went to Shanghai with, he was talking about how to get rich people to like maglev. And he said that when he went there with Bloomberg was at the airport saying, "All right, where's my limo?" And everyone said, "A limo? Why would you want to take a limo? Get on the train. It's three times faster than taking a limo in the highway." Anyway, so there's that. But then, you know, I mean, the real things about moving forward is you got specific projects. One is the space initiatives made by China. You know,
yeah, well, tell us about those, because those are really dramatic, and I think most Americans are not really familiar with them.
Well, I noticed that some Americans are unaware that China landed a rover on the moon. Maybe some of our listeners have missed that, but yes, China had landed the Jade Rabbit on the moon. They've got an ongoing program of orbiting the moon. They've now sent a lander to the moon. They're going to next go to the moon and come back, and then, you know, eventually have the idea of a sample return.
A unmanned vehicle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think first it's just going to be to go there and come back. I don't think even with certainly no people are involved in this. And then go there with a lander, get a sample return mission, which will be nice because we haven't gotten any samples from the moon in quite some time. I'm amazed that there's still Apollo moon dust left to study, that after 50 years it still hasn't been used up in experiments yet. Who would have thought 50 years later we wouldn't have been back, you know? Anyway, so they've got a serious commitment to these space programs, including explicit discussion about the use of lunar helium-3, which, you know, it's helium-3 represents a potential breakthrough in fusion that's almost as good as fusion is beyond fission. The thing is, we don't have anything that uses fusion yet, so it's hard to see what the distinction would be. But with helium-3 as a fuel for fusion, we finally get to have a nuclear system where we're not basing things on physical properties anymore. Today's nuclear power plants boil water, mm-hmm. or another working fluid, and expands, blows through a fan, and that spins a motor, mm-hmm. a generator. That's kind of archaic when you think about it.
It's about 500 or 600 years old, right?
Yeah, it's not the newest idea. Well, using electricity, it's a little newer, but it's, you know, it's...
But the electricity is produced by boiling water and running a turbine.
Yeah, yeah. So the breakthrough to make with that, using helium-3 as a fusion fuel, is that we would get to make electricity directly. I'm not going to get into why here. Maybe we could. But you get to directly make electricity. You get to use it also as a direct source of... exhaust for fusion rockets, things like this, which we're going to need if we're going to take care of these asteroids you were mentioning earlier. So that's a very serious and real commitment on their part to what the next form of Promethean fire would be. That next form of fire is on the moon.
So in other words, we don't have fusion yet. The most advanced nuclear power we have is fission.
Well, we only have fusion bombs,
We have fusion bombs, but we don't use them for peaceful purposes. We have fission energy, and we make a small amount of electricity worldwide.
Yes.
In some places, a higher percentage than others. And fusion is the next step, because then our energy flux density is higher, but our fuel is more abundant in fusion. But you're saying the Chinese are now looking at something which is even beyond what we currently don't have.
Yes, they're looking at something even beyond what we currently aren't that close to having. Right.
So that's an example of this Promethean idea of actually looking to new...
You know, and they're doing the work on fusion itself, too. I mean, they've got a fully superconducting tokamak, a fully superconducting fusion experiment. We don't have that in the United States.
And superconductivity...
Meaning
that... Explain that for our listeners.
Well, when these at least the way we're currently trying to do fusion, we've got the laser fusion, which is being explored at Livermore in California, but most fusion experiments use magnetic bottles to hold plasma as the plasma's heated and gotten to a way where it'll be so excited that it'll start fusing with itself. To do that, you need very, very strong magnets. You know, and you make a magnet by passing electricity through a wire wrapped in a coil, just like people might have done in school. Just a very big one of those wrapped in a certain kind of shape is what makes a tokamak's magnetic field. Here's the thing. You need so much electricity going through to make a magnetic field strong enough to hold the plasma in that, you know, the limitation for many experiments right now is that if they tried to run the fusion experiments longer, the wire would melt.
Okay.
So
that's a problem.
It is a problem. So the benefit of having a superconducting magnet is that then it doesn't get hot. There's no resistance to the flow of electricity, meaning that you've got the potential to run much longer experiments and then, you know, be able to learn more about plasma flows over plasma states over longer times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually that's what we would need anyway if we're going to move to a real power plant with all of this. The thing is that all of these fusion designs kind of, we'd really have to rethink the whole thing to some degree if we're using helium-3. We don't know everything about it. We haven't really done a lot of experiments using helium-3.
We don't even have very much helium-3 available.
We've got 100 pounds on the Earth, or 200 pounds, I think is the number I saw.
Right.
Not a lot. You know, there's a million tons on the moon.
A million tons on the moon.
Yeah.
And why is there more on the moon?
Well, we've got this pesky atmosphere, and we've got a magnetic field. Mm-hmm. So the sun is constantly spitting out all sorts of things, including helium-3, especially spitting out small things like helium-3. Mm-hmm. And we never get that here. The magnetic field pushes it away. The atmosphere prevents it from coming down to Earth, and helium is a small enough particle that it reaches escape velocity. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, our atmosphere doesn't float off the Earth and disappear, but helium does. When you let helium out of a balloon, that helium, it'll get in the atmosphere, and it can actually leave the planet. So we don't have any. It gets caught in the moon dust, and that's why it's actually still on the moon. It's caught in the little crusty bits of dust particles.
Right. So let me ask Megan to jump in here. Okay. So we have a lot of helium-3 on the moon. We don't have any on the Earth. If we're going to develop something which is more advanced than what we still don't have, which is helium-3 based fusion, we have to go to the moon. Now, what does that imply about man's man's location in the solar system, and where man is in the universe? I know you've done a lot of studying and lecturing on Vernadsky, the great Russian biogeochemist, who raised the question that in order for man to fully understand who he is, he has to think about the unique nature of man, this creative capacity which we talked about, as being an integral part of the development of the biosphere, the development of Earth. Now, what does this whole question of helium-3 say about where man's located with respect to that?
Yeah, well, Vernadsky is a great starting point for thinking about it, because Vernadsky, you know, you mentioned he was a Russian-Ukrainian biogeochemist, so he studied the effect of the process of life, living processes on the chemistry and the structure of the Earth's crust, and mm-hmm. how over, you know, thousands and, you know, billions of years, really, life has totally transformed the availability of chemical elements, chemical energy, and structure of the crust, concentrating elements. But then he, a little bit later, he went on to study how human thought does the same thing, but at a faster rate, concentrating higher powers. And he concluded that human thought was an incredibly unique process because it was not limited to the planet. He saw the human mind, human thought, which was the most powerful process for change on the planet, as not being something which is bounded by the planet, whereas living things are. Mm. Now, that really goes back to Kepler, who I mentioned before. Kepler lived in the late 15, early 1600s. He dies in 1630. Kepler was the first person to have a concept of the solar system as a system. There had been attempts before. Human knowledge had moved in that direction over time, and you had the Dark Ages, but Kepler was the first person who actually was able to conceive of a valid, or to make a valid discovery of how it was that the solar system behaved and acted as a single system, as opposed to just a collection of parts which mm-hmm. were all acting on each other, or a collection of planets which all happened to inhabit, you know, a small mm-hmm. space in the galaxy. So with Kepler, you had the idea that the action of the sun was akin to the action of a conductor of an orchestra, where the single thought of the sun, thought, so to speak, right, or the single action mm-hmm. of expressed in universal gravitation of the sun was responsible for each and every motion that took place within its influence. And, you know, that to me is really sort of, you can connect the thread from Kepler through to Vernadsky and get a good concept of what it would mean if the world were now to dump the British Empire and go with this direction that China's moving in. Mm-hmm. For the first time, you would have man not only having a valid concept of the solar system, but for the first time, you would have man actually implementing control over the solar system. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. We're able to understand in a Keplerian fashion the behavior of the planets of the solar system, but we're not yet out there acting to change and coordinate and exert, you know, our power in and over these bodies of the solar system. Mm-hmm. And so in a very real sense, were we to do that, that would be a fulfillment of what Kepler began in human beings subsuming the rest of the solar system in the noosphere.
Mm-hmm. So in effect, Kepler discovered this harmonic idea, or this unified idea of the solar system, which really is the idea of gravity, which, today when you say the word gravity to people, they don't have any clue what you're talking about, but that's really the idea. Now you're saying that with what China is doing, with what mankind as a whole is on the verge of right now, is we're actually controlling gravity on a level that has never even been conceived of before.
Yeah, right. In a certain sense, because, you know, Kepler, he was examining the motions of the planets. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, he discovered that the set of motions that the planets exhibit were the ratios of the speeds of the planets to one another were the same ratios as you get in a musical scale, mm-hmm. and that there were constant adjustments of one to the other so that you had the greatest amount of harmony possible. But he was only looking at planetary motions, and there are so many other characteristics to the solar system that we know of today. Chemical composition of bodies, the size of the planets, the different perturbations of the orbits, meaning the fact that the orbits actually change their shape over time, mm-hmm. The asteroid belt, Kepler didn't know about that. So there are these other dimensions to the characteristics of our solar system, which Kepler didn't get a chance to investigate. Now, by us actually going out there, we would have a chance to, you know, now have a higher idea of what subsumes all of these characteristics in a single system.
And we may even discover things about the solar system that have been existing for a long time that we're completely unaware of and oblivious to, but which have been determining other things. I mean, there's a whole level of things out there that we don't even know. Let me just remind our listeners that you're listening to the LaRouche Show. I'm here with two members of the scientific research team of LaRouche, the so-called basement team, Jason Ross and Megan Beetz, and we're talking about the new age of Prometheus. So, all right, so we've talked a little bit about space, and I think we've only just put our little toe in the water because there's a whole lot more going on there. But what are some of the other, let me ask Jason to jump in here, what are some of the other sort of frontier areas of science, technology, culture, and so forth, which really go way beyond what people are thinking are possible today?
It's funny, in some of those fields, it doesn't seem like it's we're at the forefront of them. I mean, in culture, for example, there's plenty of examples of how, you know, we don't really have a forefront of culture the same way that we have got specific motion on fusion, for example. By culture, I mean, you know, take music or that kind of thing in particular.
Well, let's just stick on that for a second, because there's something very interesting, say, when we talk about China. Right, that you talk about the forefront of culture, whereas most of the world, and I'm not, I know it's very popular in China as well, is so-called modern popular culture. But a precondition or a necessary condition for advances in culture, say in music, is you have to really have an audience, right? I mean, if you think about the development of the real advances in Western classical music occurred in a very short period of time in a very small geographical area, but there was a certain audience which in a certain collaboration or certain interrelationship between the great composers like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, and so forth, and the people who were sort of demanding that new advances take place, sort of a reciprocal type of relationship. And in China, we know that there is a huge popularity now of a huge effort to develop a constituency, so to speak, of classical culture. There are probably more students of classical music in China than, say, all of Europe combined. So we have that. I mean, I think that's one direction. But I'm wondering if, you know, or let's look at other areas. Maybe, you know, you could talk about some of the large-scale infrastructure and development projects, which are actually changing the planet Earth in a way that, you know, changing. Like, you talked about the weather earlier, that we have to modify the weather and so forth. So we're talking about, you know, the kinds of projects like the Nicaragua, the new transoceanic canal across Nicaragua, or Egypt's new Suez Canal project, or the big dam in China that they've developed. So what are the implications of this for actually transforming our concept of what the Earth is, right? I mean, in other words, people have this idea that you have nature and then you have man. But what really is the natural condition of Earth?
Yeah, right. It's sort of a concept that doesn't really exist. I mean, there is no natural condition of much of anything. I mean, if natural means an unchanging one.
Right.
I mean, there's no, you know, climate always changes, the Earth always changes, what life is around always changes, species go extinct all the time. The KT, mass extinction, which could really be called the mass flowering of new kinds of life, saw a huge, you know, a extinction of, a large, large portion of life on the planet, of animal life on the planet. It happens. That's natural. So, you know, this false idea of natural that gets used by the environmentalist movement, which should just be frankly called the anti-human movement, at least in terms of its leaders, is that people are just defined not to be natural, even though obviously we exist here on Earth. Our thoughts have power in the universe. They work. You know, this is one of Mr. LaRouche's measures of economics. Did we increase the potential relative population density? Unlike animals, we can create more and more people able to live in a certain area. Obviously, that's a real thing. It's in the universe. The power of human thought is it, you know, it's a physical principle, just like, you know, the way ferns grow or anything. I know, it's a real natural thing. Mm-hmm. So I think what China's doing, it reflects a couple of things. One is, you know, a huge physical benefit. I mean, the Move South Water North project. I mean, China overall has significant, very major water problems. I mean, China's the size of the U.S. It has much less water available than the United States does. So, you know, the kind of drought that we're facing right now is, I think, making us aware of the importance of having, you know, long-term, large-scale water capabilities. You know, China's definitely been thinking about that. The power from the dam, the ability to reshape the natural environment. It could just be called, you know, the way we found it, or, you know, the fixer-upper that we've been improving. You know, it needs repair. Welcome to Earth. Needs repair. You know, help wanted. We need some people. That you couldn't, you know, these are good things to do, and they're totally opposed by this green outlook, which is just something that we have to eliminate, and will probably in part eliminate itself as the potential for real progress is more apparent to people.
So on the green agenda, if a beaver builds a dam and it floods a creek, which wipes out or makes more vulnerable all the little creatures that are sort of living in that ecosystem, that's good. But if China builds a big dam and they, you know, relocate all the people who lived in that area to better areas, and it makes the land more arable and provides more electricity and makes life better for everybody around, that's bad.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that these metrics of good and bad, or with the beaver, they might just say natural or neutral, or, you know, no judgments there. But, you know, good and bad, instead of them having any metric of what good or bad might be, of how things ought to be, it's just how were they? What was it? Good means it was already that way. It's just saying don't do anything. I mean, that's basically all it comes down to. And then there's these, like, you know, horror stories of, well, if this species goes extinct, then this will happen, then this will happen, then this will happen. Forget it. It's just made up stuff. If we exterminated all mosquitoes on the planet, we'd be much happier for it, and I don't think we'd have an ecological disaster. We'd have less malaria.
Right, and malaria was one time wiped out with the use of DDT and... there were no malaria cases.
Right. Well, I think that the environmentalists, you know, the ex-Nazi environmentalists who, create these kinds of movements, I think they saw that increasing population of people as an ecological catastrophe on its face.
Right.
You know.
Okay, so this what you just said about good and bad, and this raises a very important question which LaRouche has talked about, which is, if we're going to have a new renaissance, it's going to either occur through or be combined with a new concept of value. LaRouche has talked about having an international conference to determine a universal concept of value. Because how do you, you know, here we're talking about, you know, for example, with helium-3 fusion, developing something which is even beyond what we currently don't have. And, how do you give that economic value, an investment of society's resources into something like that, versus, you know, what somebody thinks is economic value today? So I think it'd be real important, because this is probably something that our listeners really either fog over when they hear it and don't really think about it. But this gets really at the core of a new way of thinking, is what is a new standard of value. So, Megan, why don't you jump in here and just give us some idea as to what the implications of are that question. I'm sure most people have never actually thought about what they mean by value. They think, you know, I got a good, a value is like, you know, being able to buy something cheaper at the store than what you were expecting or something.
Yeah.
Well, what is it? Or, you know, making some investment in a stock that whose value increases, right?
Yeah, right.
So what do we actually really need to think about when we think about this word value?
Yeah, well, no, it's like what you brought up. People are so brainwashed with money today. Mm-hmm. Money. And, you know, and you'll talk to somebody and you'll say, well, you know, money doesn't mean anything. Money doesn't have any inherent value. And they'll say, yeah, I know. But then, right, but then their thinking stays in terms of, well, you know, did I make a little bit more in my 401k? Or, you know, it's this...
Money doesn't have value. It's what I can buy with it.
Yeah, right. You know, or like, Mr. LaRouche really just slammed this idea of the market. You know, the idea that the value of something is what somebody's willing to pay for it. What does that mean? So if you're, that's science, that's the most scientifically unrigorous, you would never accept that in any other, you know, any so-called scientific field, the idea that the value of this is just what, you know, what somebody's willing to pay for it, or what belief I'm willing to put in the importance of something, right? Mm-hmm. That is baseless. It means nothing. It's totally mystical. And, you know, we really are in an era where that is just, that idea and the whole system that comes from is just dead and gone. So, you know, so what is real value? You know, you look at, you know, Jason brought up this potential relative population density, Mr. LaRouche's measurement of economic progress. How many human beings could you support given your current level of scientific capabilities? You know, given mm-hmm. the land area that you're the type of land you're dealing with, if we applied all of our knowledge to transform this land, how many people could we support? You know, and so what? How do you actually think about, you think about government policy or government shaping policy? It has to be from that standpoint of, are we increasing the rate at which we're increasing our capability to support more people? Now, the interesting thing when you talk about value in that way is, not only are, you know, certain technological investments valuable, investment in diffusion power has tremendous value in that economy, whether the markets like it or not. But also you think about the value of something like culture, because mm-hmm. what is the source of these things that allow you to transform the planet and support more people? It's human discoveries. Well, how do you create more human discoveries? And this gets to the issue of the role of culture in society. How do you actually foster a culture of human beings where you have a greater density of new discoveries, new valid thoughts occurring? Mm-hmm. Well, you've got to foster the creative imaginations of the population. You've got to get people's imaginations actually in tune with the ordering of the universe. And the way you do that is through poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And this is what's so beautiful, in which we just really have to fight this irrationalism in the culture today, in the music and art culture today. The idea that culture is whatever I feel like. This is the most irrational thing. Shelley, you know, Percy Shelley thought that the poets were actually the most advanced thinkers in your society. Poets would actually be able to reflect a certain future condition of the human species, reflect new thoughts which had never been thought before, and then poets were able to embody that in language and express that to the general population so that more people could have a creative experience. Mm-hmm. Right? And so then you talk about value in that sense. Well, the real question is, what will contribute to increasing the density of discoveries and beauty and happiness in your society?
So, all right. So I guess what you're saying is that value is determined by its power to increase the imagination.
Yeah.
How do you measure that?
Well, it's one of those things, sort of like you know it once you get into it. And that's a funny definition, but you know, I mean, think about value.
I mean, you can't package it into a derivative.
Thank goodness.
No, I was thinking about value and the direction that it goes in. Just like good should be about the future, not what did we used to like. Same with value, because this definition of value in terms of what people are willing to pay for, value trails society. It doesn't lead. It can't be a leading or helpful concept to guide any decision making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when value leads society, when you step outside of where you're at or what people think about anything and think about where you need to be in the future, etc., then your concept of value can actually be useful in planning things, you know.
Well, that's important, because the other thing about Prometheus, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know whether I have this exactly right, but either Prometheus meant in ancient Greek foresight, or it became the word which meant foresight.
I think Socrates makes that pun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it Prometheus had foresight. He actually knew that that reality was not in his current condition of being chained to a rock and having his liver picked out by the eagle, but was a future condition that he had helped bring about, which Zeus could not even imagine. But it was a world without Zeus, where Zeus's power, where Zeus was undone by his own folly. And so why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that really gets to the mindset of what we're talking about. I mean, when none of us have been to China, at least not recently. We have the fortunate reports that are sort of trickling in from Helga's trip there and what we know about what's happening in China, but also in other countries, like the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, made the point that 60% of the Indian population is under 35. Those are people who have a life ahead of them. So throughout the rest of the world, there really is a sort of culture in which people are thinking about the future. And yet, even young people today in the transatlantic area think mostly about the past. And I guess this gets kind of at what I was trying to get at the beginning around this question of, do we want to go back to the good old days, or do we want to create something which has never actually been here before? And so either one of you jump in on this, but you know, I think it's really important to think about the mindset here of, you know, what it really means to think about the future. I think people in the United States and Europe probably talk about the future, but it's mostly like what you were saying with your, is my 401k going to be have enough money in it for my retirement, as opposed to what it really means to think about the future.
Well, sometimes you have the best foresight when you are making the future happen, you know? So, I mean, that's, you know, there's a couple ways of looking at that. One is the, you know, all the inside sneakiness that goes on in the stock market. They've got great foresight, but...
Well, they didn't seem to be able to forecast the crash that they were bringing about.
Well, maybe short-term foresight.
Given how many people seem to be surprised
what quality of vision this foresight has.
How many people are saying that we're in a bull market right now.
Right. You know, and then just what it means to foresee a future that's unimaginable right now. I mean, it's like, how do you have an imagination of things that simply can't happen right now? Yeah, maybe that sounds funny, but, you know, the... I'm trying to think of good examples of this, but whenever we introduce a new principle into our arsenal, the future becomes something that's just unimaginable. Like I was recollecting recently the H.G. Wells wrote this silly story called The Time Machine.
Right.
Now, when he wrote that, I guess there wasn't electricity around, because this time machine works by like twisting levers and pushing on crystals, and it's it sounds totally absurd to us. Not that we would know how to, you know, a time machine at least ought to look futuristic, but. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's simply just like there were things that just weren't even in the imagination to talk about there, like electricity. But, you know, I think the most important thing is that aspect of having a stepping outside of a wall and finding that you're actually inside a larger world. And the biggest way that happens is when you add a whole new dimension to potential human activity. When you expand the size of the infinite you're capable of participating in by having new levers to pull on, new principles at our disposal. So, you know, the world after the germ theory of disease was very different than the world before it, in a way that wasn't describable in terms before it, or the way you can't describe a higher process from a lower one, the way you can't describe how many sides a circle has, or, you know, what line you use to make an ellipse, or, you know, how to describe a... an animal from the standpoint of the atoms that make it up.
But I think also it really gets to this issue of moral responsibility. You know, we've become a very small people over the decades since the assassination of Kennedy. The United States people have just become so small in the degree of willingness to take up responsibility for creating a future. And people might not realize that that's the state that they're in, but it is. It shows up in pessimism. Oh, that'll never happen. Mm-hmm. Oh, we don't do that anymore. Oh, they'll never let that happen, so forget about it, right? And who does that recall? If you go back to Aeschylus's Prometheus play, that recalls some of the characters that came up to Prometheus and said, oh, you really shouldn't have done that. Now you're...
Boy, you screwed up.
Yeah, you screwed... Now you're suffering. Don't you wish you hadn't made Zeus so mad? But it's exactly that small mentality, and you know, you talk about the future, right? The future has to be created. That's the difference with human beings versus animals. Take the evolutionary process of the biosphere. The evolutionary process of the biosphere over billions of years has been in an upward direction. We have more complex creatures. We have more energy. There's more change happening via the biosphere today than 3 billion years ago, right? But that's not willful. That happens by the turnover of species in the extinction and creation cycles. But with human beings, it's willful. We have to decide to make discoveries and upshift our capabilities. We have to actually, you know, fight what is sometimes the painful fight of the discoverer to actually make that breakthrough. And, you know, it used to be the case in the United States that presented with huge, seemingly unconquerable problems like a drought in the western half of the nation, people wouldn't immediately say, oh, I guess we got to move out, right? People would, there was a certain mindset to get to work that we could actually solve this problem. We don't know how to do it yet, but we will,
mm-hmm.
right? And it is that issue of, are you willing to take responsibility to think thoughts that are impossible today?
Well, this gets at something which is fascinating to me. I've been thinking a lot about, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it, both of you, is what you said about the painful experience of discovery. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, there's a certain what you described here. There's a certain idea where you sort of relish confronting a problem because it poses a challenge which you get excited about to solve. There's a certain emotional state that's associated with this idea of, you know, I don't want to know the answers. I want to be confronted with questions that haven't been formulated yet, right? So, and this, of course, gets at this question of great art, which really tries to delve into these questions of human emotion. How what's the difference between really trying to sort of rejoice, as LaRouche likes to say, rejoice in the fact that you have an insurmountable problem that you need to come up with a total discovery. Like, for example, you both are very experts on Johannes Kepler, right? He had a problem to solve in terms of understanding the motions of the solar system, and when you read The New Astronomy or any of his works, you see how delighted he is when he is sort of twisted up into knots about having to figure out how to get to this, make the breakthrough. And I'm just thinking about that from the standpoint of, you know, young people, especially children, right, who we really have to direct our attention to. You know, we seem to, in our educational system, in our cultural system here in the West, have present people or sort of beat out the excitement that young children have, beat it out from them that to really relish the idea of a challenge. So what do you think in terms of, you know, how do we revive that spark like you see with Kepler, of really trying to reach out there and to discover problems which you don't even know about just for the purpose of solving them? Where do we go with that?
Well,
I mean, I would say two things. This is not some final answer. There's a lot of dimensions to that. But two things. One, I mean, we have to change society as a whole. Society has to have a direct... Like, you talk about children. Why do children exhibit irrational and pessimistic behavior? Well, part of the reason they do that is because they have a society which is going nowhere. And you can feel that from a very mm-hmm. young age. Society is not accomplishing anything in the United States. And there's just a pessimism. Children can feel that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing, you know, and then that shows up in the educational system and so forth. But the other thing is music education. I mean, children can understand music before they can understand language.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually understand musical intonations before they can understand the words that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so giving children access to classical music at the youngest age possible and actually giving them a way to access deep thoughts, giving them a way to, and also the rigor of musical education, the rigor that comes in with musical education, where you actually have to fight to learn the piece, to master the instrument, and then to be able to express a profound idea, which was composed by somebody who lived, you know, somebody like Bach, who maybe is a more profound thinker than you are at the moment, mm-hmm. but you're able to have a chance to tap into that. Mm-hmm. So, and there's two things I'd say about it, although that's not a complete answer.
I was just going to say that there's a lot of very specific problems that need solving right now. So there's certainly not there's no shortage of, you know, immediate needs for discovery. On the more general thing of what you had brought up first in introducing the subject about the difficulty or maybe the agony of discovery is that, you know, the trouble is, of course, until you know something, you don't know it. And you never know when it's going to come to you, or if it ever will, or if it'll ever happen to you again. Or maybe that was the last time and you'll never have another creative thought. You honestly don't know that that's not true. Mm-hmm. It's entirely possible that was the last time, you know, so, you know, because it's really, it's sort of up to you and the state that you put yourself in and the passion that you have to figure things out makes it possible not just to have those insights, but to have the ability to stick with it when those insights aren't there. Mm-hmm. And one specific thing about, you know, about Kepler is that, you know, in the New Astronomy, he has, after he's, you know, thrown out the geometrical ideas of people before him and introduced a physical idea of what makes the planets move, he then says, okay, let me look back at Mars again from my physical hypothesis. And he realizes that he has absolutely no idea what to do next. All he's got is the idea that planets' speeds are based on how close they are to the sun. He has no idea at all what would make them get closer or farther from the sun, though. None. So he introduces this idea, and he knows it's not a very good idea, I'm pretty sure. And then he spends six chapters working on it. It doesn't work out. It's agonizing calculations he goes through. I mean, it's painful to read them. He says, imagine how tedious this is in reading about it, oh dear reader. Can you imagine how awful it was for me to do this calculation three times? Ugh. Especially without a calculator. You make a mistake, you got to do the whole thing again. But there's something very specific that came out of his failure as he's going through this process that didn't directly lead anywhere at all. But, you know, almost fortuitously, because of something that he had found in this failed course, it set him off onto the right course at a moment of insight later mm-hmm. that would never have happened to him had he not been struggling through and working on something that didn't actually bear fruit directly. But the intent that he had made his mind receptive to be able to go somewhere with the insight later.
So you've obviously, the two of you, have benefited quite a lot by gained a lot of insight by going through that kind of detailed reliving of Kepler's struggles. So that would be something that probably should be, sort of universally available to...
Yeah. I mean, everyone should go through what Kepler did in high school.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the case. Okay, so we have about two minutes left, two, 3 minutes left. Either one of you, what other types of real challenges do you see before mankind? We've talked about the helium-3 question, you know, dealing with the drought. I mean, what's out there that people really need to start thinking that solving these problems or confronting these things is really the what mankind has to be concerned about, as opposed to these, you know, what tends to occupy the popular imagination today?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that ought to be occupying people's imaginations is how we're going to get Obama and Boehner out so that it's possible to do any of this stuff. And we can join on this trajectory that China and the BRICS and, you know, Egypt are moving in instead of sticking to our very cherished ideas that are killing us. It's like you go, you know, you say, oh, well, here's what we ought to be doing. We ought to be building this stuff, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. If we allocated money for that, it might hurt the recovery.
Well, I think as LaRouche said today, you just have to tell Obama, you know, you're no good, leave.
Mm. You gotta stop kissing the corpse, you know.
Okay, we have about a minute left. Megan, what do you have?
I think that's it. I mean, look, people, we got to get rid of Obama. Once we begin engaging with nations like China on their incredible space program, which is, I mean, their space program is well beyond their capabilities in a certain sense. What they're setting themselves up to do, they don't know how to follow through with yet. Right. But I think we have to actually begin to get engaged in these kinds of things, building this new second Panama Canal, right? Solving the drought crisis in the United States. It's in that, and we have to actually fight for the idea that we are going to go take mankind to a level that he's never been at before, which is a master of the solar system. And you know, I think that's really the thing, is do these things, get out there in the solar system and begin changing things.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. That's the message to all our listeners, that, you know, stop worrying about problems that were in the past and start facing those which you don't even know about yet. So we want to thank you for being with us. Thank you, Megan. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, listeners, for being with the LaRue Show. And we hope you tune in next week for the next edition.